What happens?
You know, she hits herself in the face, and I was like, exactly. This guy was like, that's a hard concept. I was like, for some people,
could be.
Let's make sure this is working. I think this is on. Yes, this is on. Okay, so let's go for it. Okay, so let's keep going. We're still cruising on through. So everybody survived this week of intracellular recordings, right? Yeah, and if your resume, how to change electrodes on the holders, right? Because that's an important thing to learn. So that was fun. Hopefully everybody, you might not have gotten through everything in that lab, you know, to the 100 millimolar, but at least the collective data that you collected in the lab, you understand the concepts that went on, right? Anybody have problems with that generally? Why does it that when you raise potassium outside, the membrane depolarizes? Let's just see if you got the big picture. Anybody want to volunteer?
Yes, maybe.
Sure. Bring the coffee.
Changes the electrochemical gradient.
Well, changes that electrochemical gradient. And then we could keep thinking about, you know, if that was an open response question, what would you write in there?
It changes the electrochemical gradient until, and potassium will start to flow inside until the point potassium reaches its equilibrium.
So it's new equilibrium potential. And so if we raise that potassium, the equilibrium potential changed. And because, we want to continue on with that, because the membrane is permeable of potassium, it goes towards that equilibrium potential. And you could calculate that based on the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. Not so much the Nernst equation, right? Because the Nernst equation doesn't take into effect what?
Permeability.
Right. So you want to separate that out. So, you know, a complete answer. That's the kind of answer we want, right? Because then I don't really know if you understand permeability. I don't know if you understand that the equilibrium potential went up and why the membrane depolarized, right? Okay, so potassium's going in. It's reaching that new equilibrium potential because you've changed that potassium outside. And most likely your cells did what? With that high potassium. Did they stay nice transparent color? Or did they turn kind of white, right? And that's, yes. Question.
So for the open response questions, will we receive partial credit? Like if we forgot to mention permeability?
Negative credit. No, I'm joking. yes, you'll get partial credit. That's the advantage of open response. So over the years, it's been a lot easier to give some open response questions because you get the partial credit. But cut the BS out of there, please, because there's a lot of students to grade, right? And when you have multiple choice, people like that because they can finish quickly, just put C's all the way down and walk out the door, and they're done in 15 minutes, right? But the problem is, if you miss it, you miss it, right? And open response gives you that little bit of freedom to think. And having it in the lab and having much more time, you're not going to need those 3 hours, right? But it decompresses that stress of, I have to, you know, got only 2 more minutes left, and I'm still working on it. You can write it out, right, and work it out and go back. The problem with multiple choice test questions over the years, 22 years teaching, is that people change their multiple choice answer, and what do they usually change it to? The wrong answer. It's usually that first answer that they, you know, have. And you want to read through all your multiple choice answers before you choose it, because it might be A and B or something, right? I know, I hate those exams too, right? A, B, and C, but not E, you know, that kind of thing. I'll try not to do too many of those, but a few of them, and they're going to be, I think, pretty obvious, hopefully, okay? So we'll do that, and then just to remind you, to get you ready for it, right? What are we going to do coming up? What's this?
Quiz.
Lecture quiz. What's this over here? What's this? Okay, and then you've got to watch this little mouse movie. Hopefully you watched that already. You know, motivation. You can do it. And then we have the test. So we're just going to meet, you know, we have lecture, right? And then on the Tuesday, we're not taking off lecture, and we're not taking off the lab time. Those test weeks, we meet in your lab component in your lab, right? And we want to get going quickly. And you're having 4 different exams that are going out, right? But an action potential is an action potential. How many questions can you ask on an action potential? So the basic concepts that go on, right? And you can look at those old exams. Oh, yeah, that reminds me. On your Canvas, under the files, under lecture files, you have the test bank in there. All, what, 20 pages? No, like 100 and something, I think, pages are in there, right? And remember, some of those questions don't relate to this first exam, right, are some of them were from other instructors. I just put them in there. And some of those have the answer. Some of them don't have the answer next to them. But what do I get every year when we do this? Can you tell me the answer to number 15 on test number 3? Oh, good God. Okay, I have to look that up. And, you know, but it would be a lot better, say, I read or copy and paste, right? You can even do snip screen capture, right? And put that in there. I think the answer is this, but if that's all you're going to give me, I'll say, well, think a little more, right? And why do you think that answer is that one? And then I'll say, hey, you got it, or maybe you need to think about this, right? So you can do that. Also, what did we set up for you? Facebook page, right? Now, you could use your Facebook and say, you know, work among yourselves. You know, say, hey, is this answer right? And let people respond back. Right? So this is what it's all about, to try to encourage you to have cross-discussion. Because that's the real world out there later on. You're not working in isolation. You've got to communicate.
All right. Is the test bank kind of organized by the different tests, or is it just all of the
tests? It's just all the tests in there. Okay. And so what's also good is to look at the final exams that are on there, too, because what are the final exams over the years? Cumulative, right? So if you go through there and you really know the answers, the best way is to read the question, see if you know that answer without looking at the answers, and then, oh, yeah, it's this one. And then if it's something on endocrine, well, we didn't cover that yet, right? So don't have to worry about that. Is that good? Okay. Dr. Danley wanted to remind you, and she sent out the email. People are leaving their stuff on the computers. Gosh, she's really hard on that point. So when you're done with the lab, delete, 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 and then you got to go to your trash box and empty your trash box, okay, on your computer. Email the files to yourself if you want to, right? So that's pretty good. And a little nerdness to it all. You can take your iPhone and take pictures through your ocular piece of your preps. It's kind of cool, or things that you're doing. Parents really love to see what students are doing. So that's kind of cool, too. All right. Anything else about lab in general? Hopefully you're working through it. Keep up with the quizzes. Do things. And remember, we did have some issues, I think, 3 different students. You know, you're submitting sometimes one report, maybe with your lab partner. Always email those to each other, your lab partners as well. And then you have that file, and then you have an email stamp of time and things like that. And sometimes, you know, make sure your partner's emailing it up and getting everything loaded. And then communicate with each other. Big, important things. All right. So where else are we? We are... Any questions about that, generally? Right? We're all good? Good. And everybody knows the Nernst equation? Anybody get a tattoo yet of Golden Hodgkin cats? No? Okay. No extra credit. I'm joking. All right. Do know that well, and do know why we use the Golden Hodgkin cats equation. You will get those equations on the test. Do you need a calculator? No. I hope you can do, you know, simple algebra or some math, and like 0.1 times 10, things like that, right? Okay, and, you know, don't worry about logs. I'll give you answers. If it's a log 0.1 or a log 1 or a log 10, I'll give you log 10 equals this, okay? Log 0.1 equals that. But you have to set it up, but I'm going to give you those givens, all right? So you don't really need a calculator if you can do general algebra. You know, nothing fancy. You don't have to work out a log. You don't have to work out an ln. And you'll be given RT over F. You'll be given that number, okay? So that already tells you where you are. So you don't really need calculators. All right. It's the concept I want you to get out of all this, right? Okay, so we left off talking about different types of action potentials and why some cells might give a burst of action potentials and another cell might only give one action potential when you depolarize it, right? And we went through some phases of this, and I know that you've had action potentials over and over again, but just to make sure that we get some of these concepts down, if this is the membrane potential, and we're at RP, which is resting membrane potential, what's this little bump? Graded response, and then we get to some magical potential. What's that magical potential called?
Threshold
of the voltage-gated sodium channels. Boom. They open up. They want to go to E-sodium, right? Where is E-sodium? It's a very high plus value, right? Probably like plus 55 or something. So, boom, the sodium wants to go to the E-sodium. Goes up, right? E-sodium. Doesn't quite reach E-sodium. Again, this is a review. Why is it that it doesn't reach E-sodium? 2 things we have to think about. Did we cover this before? No? Yes? Maybe? Not yet? Okay. But you do know some of this from way back 152, but I know we forgot all that stuff. So there's two reasons it doesn't go to the E-sodium. It wants to go to the E-sodium. Are we okay with E-sodium? You know what E-sodium means, right? Equilibrium potential for the sodium, right? Yes? It becomes deactivated, exactly. Not just deactivated, let's call it inactivation. So as a sodium channel, a voltage-gated sodium channel, if it's in the membrane, it's closed, it's ready to go, okay? But as soon as it senses the right voltage, those amino acids, which are charged, gives it the ability to sense it, right? So the amino acid sequence is important. It senses that voltage across the membrane, opens up, becomes an ion channel, sodium's going to rush into the cell, boom, get the upstroke of the action potential. But then there is that protein continually changing its conformation, going into an inactive state. It stays in that inactive state until the membrane comes back down to rest, and then it can reset itself and be ready to open up again, right? So, inactivation of the sodium channel, and then one other thing. Two things that we really should remember. Let's just put this over here and I'll draw over there. Hopefully that. Another factor, what else happens as you depolarize that membrane and the action potential? How does it come back down? Potassium. But how do those channels open up? There's another threshold. And that other threshold is for the potassium channels. On that rising phase, somewhere up there, there is another threshold for the voltage-gated potassium channels. So don't just say potassium channels, say voltage-gated potassium channels, because at rest, you have leak channels that are open, which are mostly potassium permeable, right? Some sodium. But so these are voltage-gated potassium channels that open, and where's the E-potassium? Way down here, right? Way down here somewhere. So as soon as those open, potassium wants to go out of the cell and bring it back down to the E-potassium. So this is one. These are the two main reasons you don't reach E-sodium when you're going on the upstroke of the action potential. Because voltage-gated sodium channels are inactivating. You opened up voltage-gated potassium channels. And we generally just say one, you know, type of voltage-gated potassium channels. But really, even on the squid axon, the squid shape of this action potential, there are like five different types of potassium channels. I don't want you to memorize all those. There's some that open very quickly and some that open with a delayed opening. But generally, just say voltage-gated potassium channels. But there's really quite a number of different types of voltage-gated potassium channels. So those open up, and then the sodium channel is inactivated, starts to come back down towards E, potassium. If it goes below the resting membrane potential, that's called hyperpolarization. Sometimes you see this after hyperpolarization, just after. Hyperpolarization is fine. Sometimes it comes right back down to the resting membrane potential. Many cells come right back down to the resting membrane potential. They don't hyperpolarize. What might you think about that? Why it would just come right back down to the resting membrane potential and wouldn't hyperpolarize below rest? Question, like an open response type of question. What would be the reason for that?
It's like the E-potassium.
Is what?
Is at the...
Right, it's at the resting membrane potential. If E potassium is at the resting membrane potential, then it's not going to go any lower. All right. Sometimes people are confused by this graph over the years. Multiple questions. This is the conductance, and it's a little confusing with ionic current that's in some textbooks. This just shows that the membrane conducts sodium. There's a conductance of sodium that's right here. When the action potential is going up. And then you can see the conductance goes down to the sodium. Then the voltage-gated potassium channels. It's really a little confusing here because they're really opening a little earlier than the peak of the action potential. But the take-home here is the conductance of potassium increases, and this is what brings it back down. And then if you're down here, what opened those potassium channels initially? Voltage. But when you're down here, do you have that voltage anymore? No. So they're going to start to close, and then what keeps it go back up again? Your most energy-demanding process in your body probably is the sodium-potassium pump. So it then goes back up to rest and maintains that potential. Okay? So are we good with this? All right. So now I want to show you something that I'm not going to make you recapitulate this whole thing, but I think it might help you experimentally understanding how people got the idea of these conductances and how these channels work. It's called an IV curve, a current voltage relationship. So I'm just going to do this because some people might conceptually understand this better than what we just went through to try to memorize things. So we have these two lines. Okay, you get this. We're not going to play tic-tac-toe. All right. So now we have voltage over here. Voltage. This is plus. This is minus. We have current on this side. I equals current, right? Current. And by definition, this is inward current. And this is outward current. Okay. And so let's say we're at resting membrane potential at minus 70, let's say, millivolts. Okay. And we are going to block all the other channels, potassium, calcium, if there's a chloride channel, we're going to block all those with drugs. And we're just going to allow sodium to go across the membrane. Okay. And what are we going to do? We are going to take this experiment, like they did with the squid axon, and we're going to give current steps, or voltage steps, to the membrane. All right. It depends on how you do the experiment. But let's use voltage steps. We'll go from minus 70, you know, to maybe minus 60, and then maybe minus 50. Okay, can you see that chaos? All right. And then you come back down. So these are really fast steps. What do you do when you do that? Let's say we go to minus 60. All right. What happens to the membrane? Did we get any sodium to go through? Maybe just a little bit. And since sodium is a plus 1, and it goes into the cell, that's an inward current. Okay. So sodium's going in. A little bit of sodium goes in. It gives us this current, right? Current down here. So a little bit of sodium goes in. If we step up a little bit higher, or higher, or higher, or higher, right? Then we can plot this. And we can say, oh, if we now go to, you know, minus 40, minus 20, minus 10, 0, plus 10, plus 20, plus 40, plus 50, let's say. Okay, now we can plot this graph. Okay, and then we can draw lines. This is why filling in the dots is important in kindergarten. All right, so now we have the whole plot of the sodium current. And you can see the driving gradients. So what's happening? As you come along here, and I should draw this a little bit stronger downward stroke, I guess. That'd be better if I drew a stronger one. So I know my drawing's a mess. All right, so it really starts to conduct in. What did we find right here when all of a sudden it started to jump inward? Well, now we know the threshold of the voltage-gated sodium channel. So right here is threshold of those voltage-gated sodium channels. And usually you write it like a sodium with a V next to it. Well, we go through here and we find out when we get to 0 millivolts, you know, that we depolarize the membrane this much, we had this much current, kind of the peak. But then as we started to get more and more positive, the current started to drop. Why? We're closer to the e-sodium, the driving gradient's not as great. But what happened right here? What if we depolarized it? Let's put plus 50 about here, sorry, plus 50. What if we depolarized it to like plus 60? Here, it started to go what? It started to go outward. We went above this potential. Now we're, the cell's so positive that if you open up voltage-gated sodium channels, it's so positive inside, sodium doesn't want to go in, right? It's plus charge. It wants to actually allow the little bit of sodium that's inside the cell to go out. So it goes out. So what is this value? When it reverses at zero, current, that is E sodium. That's the equilibrium potential for sodium. So you see how the people a long time ago calculated this and they did these experiments. They actually did the experimentation and then they found these values like threshold and the E sodium and then they could go back and look at their equations. All right, so you get the idea. And I know it's a little bit, you know, hey, this is like currents and voltages. But hopefully, if you understand how they did the experiments, it makes sense.
So is that when it goes outward? Yes.
Yes, right there at that point.
Someone said that.
Mm-hmm. Right, because now the current is zero here, right? This is current. And if it's zero, that's the equilibrium for sodium. Oh, yeah. No, it could keep on going up if you made it more and more positive. Yeah, just, yeah, keeps going out. But it's very low sodium in there.
So back to this picture over here. So does the sodium voltage gated channels open at the bottom and then the potassium
they're going to open up about right here. This is just a graded response, kind of that leak current that we've been talking about, monovalent current. But then right here, when you got them all open, boom, they open up and depolarizes itself, right?
And then the potassium is...
they're opening up like up right by that rising phase, and then that wants to go, you know, bring... Now let's just think, what would the voltage-gated potassium channels, if we block the sodium, block the calcium, block the chloride, what would the potassium channels look like? It would look something like this. Remember, it goes outward, right? So now we have this outward current, and it comes like this, and it's going to cross down here. So this is for potassium. All right? And you see that as you depolarize it, more and more potassium, you're farther and farther away from where it crossed the line here. This is now E potassium right here. Okay? I'm not going to make you do the IV curve, but for some of you, I think that helps to understand the experimentation and how they derived these equations and experimentally came up to this. Now, with a little bit of stopping right there, a little tangent, what is this kind of, what I'm trying to get at? The experimentation, look at your observations, and then come up with a prediction, and then you test it, right? What do we generally call that? Yeah, the scientific method, right? The nature of science, how you go about science, right? Experimentation. Does it fit your hypothesis, your postulations? Test it in different ways, and that's what they did. They now changed the ion concentrations inside the squid axon and changed the ion concentrations outside and saw, well, now if we do that, does the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation match the new E potassium? Does it match the new E sodium? So the nature of science is to do experimentation, test your predictions. You can make predictions with science. That's the advantage of it. And I'm bringing up nature of science for a reason. Maybe think about that for a couple weeks down the line. All right. All right. So that's really good. All right. So that's just a little bit of a different explanation for this, and hopefully that helps to some of you that might be seeing this in a different way to understand these concepts. All right. Any questions? Mm-hmm. We're good. Yes.
So, I was understanding like what you were drawing and everything. That is that for the bottom graph then that you were trying to?
This is different. This is a little bit. This is conductance. And conductance. I don't want to get into it in this class too much. But conductance is 1/resistance.
Okay.
Right. But it's another aspect to it all.
-70. That's inside the cell. Or is it
that's the membrane potential.
Okay.
Right. Just across that membrane, right? Good. And I know that that's maybe the hardest part to really understand some of these electrical events of the cells.
Yes. Did you say during somewhat during the rising phase that channel of potassium is going out during the rising phase?
Not. Maybe a little bit through the leak channels if it's whole sodium's opened up, but not to the voltage gated potassium channels.
But
it's, you know, most of that's going to be really voltage-gated potassium channels. And remember, this is only about a millisecond, 2 milliseconds that we're talking about. So it's really fast, right, to come back down.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about changing action potential with... Now, I think we mentioned a little bit about it. How would the action potential change? Remember that $100? No one's getting $100 yet. I still got it. It's in my wallet, waiting to give it to you. At the nerve terminal, what's different? And we're going to talk about that in synaptic transmission coming up. Okay? A lot of this work in this second best preparation, the squid, really the crayfish is first, but you know, squid. A lot of this work came from using the squid large giant axons in here. And it's really a syncytium of multiple axons, multiple neurons, sorry, that makes an axon. So it's a big cell, it's like your finger, pinky. You could actually take that axon out, squish out the cytoplasm like toothpaste, and this is what they did. And then you could actually put different solutions inside the squid axon, tie it off like a little tube, put a wire inside, tie off the other side, put the whole squid axon with the wire in there into a bath, and that bath was basically seawater a long time ago. And serendipitously, that seawater mimics the extracellular concentrations pretty much of the salts for the squid. It's an invertebrate, marine invertebrate generally. They have these higher, as we talked about before, higher levels of sodium outside, higher levels of chloride outside of their cells, and it's very similar to seawater. So they did most of their experiments really in seawater, and they figured out how these squid axons actually work. So it's pretty cool. A guy at, I was in Woods Hole, and you should think about those summer courses I told you about applying to those things. You know, when I was at Woods Hole one summer, it was really amazing. These people upstairs from me, this postdoc, when we got together, they worked with squids, I worked with lobsters. They loved me because we only used their claws. And they had these nice tails, and they were all packed in the freezer. And so every Sunday when the cafeteria wasn't open, they'd say, "Cooper, knock, knock, knock." And so we'd have a cookout with lobsters, and they would bring down dried squid, and we'd have potato chips and beer if you're over 21, all that good stuff, right? And then have a cookout. But what they were doing upstairs was really cool. And what's nice about these kind of environments, you can go to different labs. They were actually squishing out the cytoplasm, putting it on a glass slide, and keeping it cold, like on ice, and that cytoplasm stayed like a toothpaste. That was really cool. And then they threw away the axon. They weren't interested in doing any studies with that. But what they did is they stained up the vesicles with a dye. And they could actually watch the vesicles move in the cytoplasm. It was so cool. And they were watching it with a microscope. And this gal was doing this and said, "Yeah, we're trying these different things about phosphorylation of these proteins." And they would put this drug on that would phosphorylate a protein called synapsin. And they all of a sudden the vesicle would just stop. It would come off the cytoskeleton. And that was really cool at the time. I thought, oh, that's really neat. That's, you know, very cool. A few years later, Paul Greengard gets the Nobel Prize for doing what? Phosphorylation of synapsin and watching how the vesicles come off the cytoskeleton. Was the postdoc mentioned in that? You know, so this is kind of interesting. You know, the lab was doing it. I didn't even see Paul Greengard that whole summer. But basically, his lab was working day and night. That lab never shut down. That lights were on 24/7. And that's the kind of environment of those places. But they were working their tails off and then trying to figure out what proteins were phosphorylated. They did that in the squid axon, which relates to your nerve terminals as well, or fruit flies, or C. elegans, or other things. The gods in the field, back when working with squid axons, when they could get squid, they were working with it. When they couldn't get squid, guess what? They would work with plants. And they would work with algae and all different kinds of plants. And the sodium channels that are in plants are also blocked by TTX, tetrodotoxin, from the puffer fish. So what does that tell you about the voltage-gated sodium channels? In a plant, they would be blocked. In an animal, they would be blocked. They'll be blocked in you, too. That means a similar homology, right? And they work pretty much the same way. From plants to humans, the voltage-gated sodium channels work pretty much the same way. So a lot of the early experiments that were done by these people understanding animals and how their channels worked, they were also working on plants and understanding how their channels work. So it's really quite neat to think about it holistically and put it all together. All right, so I already told you about this kind of experiments and that this is how they would actually do these experiments. This is how they got the shape of the action potential and understanding this process. If they changed out the bath with lower and lower sodium, what do you think would happen to the action potential shape when they redo these experiments? It would go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 as you lower the extracellular sodium, right? So that makes sense. You put the sodium back, then all of a sudden it pops back to like 6 in this experiment, right? So these are the early experiments that these people did. Really cool stuff. Now, these are these kind of IV curves that I was just talking about. Let's just look at this, for example, this first one. If we depolarize the cell way up there at the top A, you step the voltage up, and you block all the other currents, you would get first the sodium to come in. And what happens to those channels after they open up? They inactivate. This is the inactivation of that. If we did another experiment and we blocked the sodium channels with TTX and calcium channels, and we did it the other way, and we only had potassium channels, what would happen if we stepped it up? We open up the potassium. And the longer you kept that open, you could then actually have the potassium. You can subtract these two out and then get just the potassium or just the sodium current. So these are the kind of experiments that were done with the whole cell. This kind of explains that IV curve that we went through initially. I don't want you to have to memorize all this, but I want you to understand this is the whole cell, all right, how the whole cell works. And then we're going to talk about something else. Yes. Oh, they could do total current, for example, you know, all the ion channels opening up, and then put a blocker on, like just TTX, and then take, just, you know, see what else happens, subtract the two out, and then you would have just the sodium. Or if you put a blocker on for the potassium channels,
and you looked at total current, and then you could subtract that out, and now you have what was left over. Right? So this is how they did those experiments, just pharmacologically. So if you had to explain that in open response test question, you know, they could actually use a blockers for sodium channels or potassium channels, look at the total current, subtract out the current, you would have what that particular channel contribution was to the total current. Okay? Why we're going down this little rabbit hole is to understand this next phase. If you look at single channels, okay, single channels in the membrane, how can you look at a single channel? Because all the experience we talked about so far of a whole cell, right? All the channels. So a technique was described called patch clamping. And they got the Nobel Prize for this, the two Germans, Sockman and Nair. And they were really good. And so they came up with this technique called patch clamping. And they got the Nobel Prize for the technique. And why it's so powerful, because it understood how the channels, single channels work. So what they could do is to take a microelectrode like what you were working with, but a little bit smaller, potentially, it depends on what cell they're on, put it on the membrane, pull a little vacuum, make a seal with the membrane, so you don't break the membrane. And now they might have one or two channels in that membrane. Now they could, in that solution that they had in the pipette, they could add TTX, or add the potassium channel block, or whatever it is that they want to block. And now they can understand how a single channel works, okay? So what would they do? They would then do the same experiment. Give a voltage step, see what happens to the channel. And now they see this channel opens up, it gives some current in there, and then it closed. You do it again. You do it again. This one flickered a little bit. Open, close, maybe. Or maybe it's two channels. Now, if it's two channels, they would have to open at different times. But what would happen if we maybe had three channels in there? What would it look like? Would they all be, you know, different times opening? Probably not. They might open all at once, right? Or little steps. So you might see one, and then you might see a bigger step and a bigger step. So if you saw a trace like this that came down and then came down again, or maybe straight away a really big current and then went up, but you had a lot of those, and if you divided that into the ones over here that gave the big steps, what would you get? Some unitary value, right? So then you would know that, oh, there's probably three channels that opened up right away because I got three times the current of some of them when I only got one channel opening. And this is exactly what they did. So when they did these experiments and averaged them, so you do 1,000 experiments, what did they get? They got something like this. What did that remind you of? That reminds you of doing the experiment and only getting the sodium for the whole cell. So basically, the take-home of this is the single channels, if you have an ensemble average of how the single channels work, they represent all the voltage-gated sodium channels on that membrane, basically, right? But you can understand how the single channel works by using patch clamp techniques. Okay, so let's look at here. This might be a potassium channel, for example, or something else. Maybe it's a sodium channel. Just to make that point again. What do we see here? We see some unitary current. And then we see another one and another one. So how many channels do you think would be in this membrane? Let's say it's a potassium channel, for example.
Three.
Three, right? Now, some years people count all of these and they go like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And I get this large number, but that's not the answer, right? Because they're staying open. If it's potassium channels, they're not inactivating, and they could stay open if you depolarize the cell, right? So this is the idea. Okay, so now we understand how single channels work. It's all because of the properties of what? The amino acid sequences.
How do you know this?
Because it would only be three unitary steps. One, two, three, and you never got any more than three. So at least three. It could be more, but they would have to open up at a different time. You never saw a fourth, so they would look at that. This really helped people because they would go around on the cell and patch different regions like the cell body or the axon hillock, right, where the axon comes together. And when they patched there, they found, whoa, I'm getting like, you know, 20 channels that open. This is where the threshold is, where high density of voltage-gated sodium channels are, right? Many opened up all at once. So they could map out the cell and look at
the different properties and the density of and types. So density and types of ion channels. Let's go back to the shape of the action potentials to give rise to the shape of the action potential, right? The density and the types of ion channels. So this is what they did in early experiments. Some of those early experiments to understand where the site of spike initiation is was actually done in, what's your favorite preparation again? Crayfish. They actually did that in sensory neurons in the crayfish preparation and helped them document where the site of spike initiation is. And it was in a sensory neuron in the abdomen of the crayfish. So it was pretty cool. So like we talked about early on, first day of class, I think pretty much, ion channels, mutations in those. If we had a mutation maybe in some extracellular domain that didn't really have major contribution, maybe it wouldn't be a big problem. But if you had a mutation in the pore of the ion channel, ooh, that could be a real problem, right? Or maybe in the voltage sensing part of that channel, it won't work right, right? So this is why people sequence these channels to understand different genetic mutations and or make them differently, and then you can understand how those work. You all know that already, so those are just extra questions. You understand the Nernst equation, and that finishes that kind of PowerPoint. And then we're on to another one. You don't escape yet. Okay. So now we're still trying to understand electrical events in cells and how electrical conduction goes on in cells. And so this diagram here explains electrical conduction down the cell. But every year, there's different textbooks, and the way they present it sometimes confuses people. The biggest confusion that happens over the years is that they think this is the axon here, and that this is the cytoplasm. This isn't it in these drawings. This is the biolipid membrane of one side of the cell, okay? So this is, really, you could draw another one over here. This is inside the cytoplasm of, like, the squid axon, okay? What did we talk about? Capacitance of the membrane, resistance of the membrane. And in this example, we're only thinking about graded responses. This is where it gets confusing sometimes. Just think about this as a graded responses that we're looking at, okay? And this is inside the axon, this is across the axon, and this is the capacitance. So let's put this in some general terms so we could understand. You take a garden hose, hook it up to the faucet, turn on the faucet, water comes out the other end, right? All right, so it comes out the other end. It can only transport so much water, right? What would happen if you got your test back in 350 and you're all frustrated and you went out to that garden hose and you took out your anger with an ice pick and you stabbed your garden hose all over? What's going to happen to the water pressure at the end of that hose now? It's going to be higher? Decrease, right? So why would it decrease? You poked a bunch of holes in that membrane. It's no different than poking a lot of holes in the membrane with leak channels. So if we had a lot of holes in here, and membrane resistance is down, right, low, then it's going to drop very fast as you go along. If we didn't have these holes in there, membrane resistance is high, with fewer of them, we will maintain that potential as you go down the side. Okay, so that's the membrane to think about, all right? Now let's think about another example. If we take that garden hose, we look at how much water comes out, you know, so much water. And you hooked it up to, you know, this big faucet, and it went down to a little garden hose. You can only get so much water out. Why? Because of the resistance in there, right? Now, let's switch out the garden hose to a fire hose. Can you get more water out of the fire hose? Yes, because of less resistance, right? So now, think about the garden hose, fire hose, for internal resistance in the axon. If you have a small axon, you have a high resistance. This is a general take-home of this. If you have a larger axon, you have less resistance. So you can travel quicker down this large fire hose than you could the garden hose. And I know that's conceptually a little bit weird with electrical potentials, but generally that kind of scenario holds true, because if you took a large axon and you stimulated it one side and you recorded down here, the conduction would be faster down there and it wouldn't decay as much. Now take a small axon, stimulate, and it's going to be slower and it's probably going to decrement. It depends on some other conditions too that we're going to talk about. But if you kind of know that scenario, you'll have it down, and that appears in standardized exams too.
So what's on the left, an axon, and then what's on the right, the resting membrane potential?
No. This is the membrane, the bilipid membrane of one side. So if you draw an axon like this, draw a big circle, and you could recapitulate this over here, this is inside, this is the cytoplasm of the cell, this is outside the cell. This is just measuring the potentials as you go along that axon. So right here, you inject current, this current pulse, and you measure the potentials as you go down this axon. All right?
The leak channels affect the capacitance?
Not so much capacitance, but because we're just thinking of capacitance just to be able to charge, build up charge. But you will, just on the membrane. But remember, it just charges up and it comes down quickly because all you do is charge it up and then there's no more charging up. It maintains it.
Yeah.
Right. So,
once it charges,
that's it, basically. Okay, so hopefully that helps you understand this. Now, there's some terms that we have to remember. Remember that we talked about tau and lambda? We didn't talk about lambda yet. That's what I'm going to talk about. Here's lambda. We talked about tau. Anybody remember what tau is? What's tau? Time to get to 63%. We're going to talk about the decay, too. R, your favorite initials. Okay. So if we inject current here in this axon, and we measure along this axon the different potential amplitudes, right, as it drops, at the distance where it drops 63%, that is now termed lambda, the length constant. All right, so what makes up lambda? It's a little bit more complicated than tau. It depends on the axon diameter. It depends on the axon membrane resistance. I don't want you to have to memorize the formula, but, you know, the general ideas, okay? And why is this important? Well, let's think about this. Why are these two things important that we've been talking about with tau and lambda? Yes. Yeah, from where you inject it. No, that's all right. Thanks. Let's have a synaptic communication onto this dendrites. Let's say these are your alpha motor neurons in your spinal cord. All right? And we're having communication onto these dendrites. We release transmitter. It goes across. Let's say those receptors are inotropic receptors. They open up and allow sodium to go in. So what's going to happen if we could get an electrode inside of that? What would we see? We would see some graded depolarization, right? Well, okay, we gave some communication from this nerve. We stimulated this nerve here. It released transmitter, went across, bounded those receptors. They opened up, allowed sodium to go in. It depolarized that membrane. We got a graded response now from maybe minus 70 to maybe minus 60, okay? Great. What's this going to do for the cell? Well, now it's going to travel down the cell, right? Down the dendrite. It's going to hit the cell body, which has a large surface area now. And what does it have on the surface area? Little leak channels. It's got a lot of membrane now. It has to neutralize that capacitance to travel down here. So what's it going to look like when we record in here? Maybe much smaller, right? So now it gets smaller. And now it's coming down to the site of spike initiation where we have a lot of voltage-gated sodium channels. But we record right before that, and it's a little wimpy thing. Is it going to be above the threshold to activate the voltage-gated sodium channels? Maybe not, right? So lambda has a factor here, right? If it decayed so much as it went down here because of these properties, it's not going to open up the voltage-gated sodium channels. Well, let's do something different. Let's look at some other factors. Let's look at giving two signals really quickly. So now we're going to give two. Boom, boom. Or maybe three. Boom, boom, boom. All right? And now we look at this, and if we record it in here, what do we see? We might see something like this. And before it could come back down, we activate it again, maybe some other receptors, and we activate it again, right? And then it comes back down. All right? And then we go through here, we go down here, and now what do we have down here? We might have some smaller events because they all decremented, but what did we get? We might be above threshold now, so we could activate an action potential. Get the idea? So this is why lambda is important, but also why is tau important. So look at this. If this had a low tau, what would this look like? If it was a small tau, let's say now instead of that, we would have this. And the tau was small. Activated again, small. Activated again, small. Right? So when you got down here, if you had, they might all get smaller,
but they're not adding on each other anymore, right? So you get the idea of why tau is important, why lambda is important, because it can build on that. So if we had a membrane with a lot of leak channels, tau is going to drop really fast. So low tau, remember, the amplitude, right? So tau, only think about amplitude. Lambda, think about length. The two go together to look at this electrical potential as we get down to, say, the site of spike initiation. And I know that's a little bit complicated, and it could be confusing, but we just keep drawing it out. Best way to study for this is to take a blank piece of paper and redraw things out, right? Now think about if we had communication on this side and this side at the same time. So we get a potential over here, and maybe just one communication over here, and we get another response. Well, what's going to happen? They're going to come down to the cell body, right? And if we record it in here, if they happened at the same time, what's going to happen if we record in here? We might get a bigger response. We might get an additive response, right? Maybe they're a little bit off, just a tiny bit off, but then we might get something like that, right? So you get the idea. We could have spatial summation, spatial, different distances, spatial summation in 1 second, or we could have multiple events like this, temporal summation. So temporal summation down this one dendrite, spatial summation down different dendrites. Question? Oh, you mean coming back into the axon?
Yeah,
it could. Actually, we're going to get into synaptic transmission just in a bit. It's sometimes the reuptake, but in many cases, it's not really the reuptake that makes the biggest difference. In some cases, it's really these receptors are kind of like the voltage-gated sodium channels. If you activate these receptors and with an agonist, like a dual neuromuscular junction, acetylcholine, they actually open up, but they inactivate. And then the acetylcholine has to be broken down. Some of it's taken back up. But if you kept acetylcholine around that synaptic cleft, those channels have not been able to reinitiate the state to be active again. And so you can actually desensitize. The word here is now desensitize those receptors. That's a really good question, because how do nerve gas agents work and how can they cause you a problem? And this is where we're going to get into next. All right, so you kind of got this down now. So what are the take-home points here? Lambda, tau, and how they influence the electrical potentials, right? And now, you know, spatial summation, temporal summation, garden hose, fire hose, ice pick, you know, with one type of hose, right? Hopefully that helps you remember all those. Good. A little bit to remember this early in the morning, I know. Okay, so how can we generally change some of these properties so we don't decrement that signal, that graded response? Well, one way is to not have to neutralize that capacitance that's built up along the membrane. If we have to have sodium come in, like this right here, sodium come in, it's coming in this voltage-gated sodium channel, it's moving along the membrane, but it's having to neutralize this charge that's all along the membrane as it travels along. How can we reduce that capacitance? This isn't all perfectly right, but the general idea is like this. Remember what capacitance in the physics experiment? Two metal plates, the closer they are together, the more interaction, right? More capacitance is going to build up. The farther apart for those two plates, they don't sense each other anymore. So not as much capacitance. How can you separate these plates in biological system? Insulate it. You wrap myelin around it, and now you've separated those plates. So there's less charge buildup. The idea is less charge buildup across from the outside to the inside of the cell. And if that occurs, then what's going to happen? You can travel very quickly because you don't have to neutralize that charge. So when you produce an action potential at the nodes of Rambier, this is where the voltage-gated sodium channels are, boom, sodium rushes in, you get a big action potential, and that action potential can travel to the next node without having to neutralize much charge. So what did it do to the speed of conduction? Sped it up. So myelinated neurons have a faster action potential than non-myelinated neurons because you can speed it up. The word here is saltatory conduction that you might see in textbooks. Saltatory means jumping, so it jumps from node to node to node, and it can travel very quickly. So myelination helps speed up the conduction velocity. But what else did this allow? Think about it on an evolutionary term or a comparative aspect. This allowed systems to actually have smaller axons. But if you myelinated it, you could still get really good conduction. The faster axons, like in some animals like the squid, how did it deal with fast responses? It had big axons, low resistance, right? But it takes a lot of space. And then you got a lot of nutrients, you have to keep that axon healthy and everything. So different ways, this is like what you call convergent evolution, different ways that this could have occurred in nature. Some animals, for very fast conduction, think about that squid in that system that we showed. You know, a predator comes by, touches it in the tail, it can jet really quickly, right? You probably couldn't catch it if you were swimming in the water faster than you, right? You get Phillips to swim with it, and the squid would win, right? So you can't catch it. It's an escape response. And that is from that large axon. Travels the electrical potential, hits those muscles, and allows it to contract quickly and escape. So you see a very fast response. Look at the crayfish. When you were dissecting your crayfish, when you picked it up, did it tail flip? Some of them tail flip on you, right? That little tail flip, through circuitry from sensory neurons to the CNS to the motor neurons, that tail flip in the ventral nerve cord, there's a large axon in there. And what does that do? Allows fast conduction. Even with the head cut off, and you cut it off the abdomen, you just have the abdomen, and it can tail flip, right? It's that activation of that large interneuron that had fast conduction that activated the motor neurons to allow it to tail flip. That's pretty cool. So when you look at different animals and you look at fast responses, you can think, oh, you know, it probably has some ability to conduct really fast to escape from predation. So there's a guy, Dan Hartline, in Hawaii, and if you want to go do some undergraduate research, you know, apply to that lab. And he looked at these little tiny copepods, tiny little marine invertebrates. And he noticed that, and his dad won the Nobel Prize, there was a lot of pressure on him. His dad won the Nobel Prize with vision and horseshoe crabs, but and understand our vision works. But then Dan Hartline, you know, I got to do something good, my dad got the Nobel Prize, you know, pressure, pressure, pressure. So he looked at these little copepods, and he noticed these tiny little animals. If you touch it, they can move so fast. They can just... And so when we talk about synaptic transmission, we're going to think about chemical transmission from one nerve to another. There's another type of transmission called gap junctions. We talked about that a little bit. From one nerve to another nerve, you can get electrical signals, like through your heart. And he thought, maybe those have gap junctions because electrical activity goes so fast that they can tail flip. So he looked at them. Now, they didn't have gap junctions, but they had large axons. The tiny little animal had these kind of larger axons so it could go really fast, so the electrical signal could travel fast to the next neuron. So he thought, oh, that's pretty cool, you know? These tiny little animals have these big axons. And some of the snapping shrimp that you might have seen on TV or stuff, for that snapping and just to respond quickly, they actually, if you touch them, some of that circuitry is actually large axons that can go really quickly to give that response fast. But then people started looking at other snapping shrimp. And then he found another copepod down by Australia. And it's a different species. And he thought, oh, this is pretty cool, but it's very similar. You know, just a different species of these little copepods. And they can move really fast, too. But they looked a little different. He thought, oh, yeah, okay. So they got these large axons, too. But he wanted to show that because they were moving really fast also. And so he dissected them open, did electron microscopy, looked at the nerves. Small axons, super small axons. What on earth, how are they moving so fast? But guess what he saw around them? Wrappings. Not really myelin, but it's the same idea. There were wrappings around these small axons to keep the capacitance down. So two different ways, copepod species, to move fast. One, larger axons. The other one, small axons, but myelinated. In some snapping shrimp, you'll see the same thing. There's actually wrappings around some of these axons for that circuit to go fast. Other ones, larger axons without the wrappings. Two different ways to speed it up, similar types of species, but you see the different types of evolutionary processes that went on to actually speed this up. Okay, so this is the idea, and you're going to be maybe doing this in one of the labs, experiments, potentially. This gets confusing sometimes, so let's pay attention to this one. So what we've done is we stimulated one side, and we recorded the end of the axon. Okay? A nerve. Correct me. That's a nerve, not a single cell. Many axons. Many neurons. Okay? Many neurons. Hundreds of neurons. So this is a nerve, like your sciatic nerve. Stimulate one end, record at the other end. What happens when you record at the other end? The first signals you got was something like this. Boom. And then a little bit later on your trace, you got that. And a little bit later, that came on the trace. Well, that tells you that there's different signals coming down that cell. If you looked at these are large myelinated axons. These are smaller myelinated axons, and even smaller ones. And then as we go way down there, there's some that are unmyelinated and small. So they have different conduction velocities. Why are they different amplitudes? This is the confusing part for people's nerves. You have to think these are ensemble averages of all those in that group. This is an average. So some, that there just happens to be more alpha types of neurons, single cells, in this particular nerve. Maybe take out another nerve, and you might see a small wave here, and a bigger wave of beta, and maybe another small wave of gamma. Just tells you there's a different percent of those axons that are in there. So you could think of, if you were just looking at one, you might see a little signal here, but the majority of them sped at this speed, right? So it's an average. So this is what's called a compound potential, a compound action potential. It's not a single action potential, but when you hear the word compound action potential, it's many signals coming together. So this is a compound potential because it's many axons traveling, and the majority of this group, it travels at this speed. The majority of this group travels at this speed. The majority of this group travels at that speed. That's the confusing part that people confuse. All right? So this is called the compound action potential. They have different conduction velocities because of this right here. A-alpha, like your motor neurons in your body, they average axon diameter, pretty big. The fast conduction velocity. Some of these in ours can travel at 120 meters a second. 120 meters in a second. Right? So we always like to go to middle schools and think how fast they can run. Can they run as fast as an action potential? You know, get them thinking about it. Of course they can't, right? And then you draw it out like 120 meters and tell them go. And they take like one step and say, oh, you lost, you know, your action potential went faster. Just to get them thinking about the whole process. So axon diameter, big, smaller, smaller. Conduction velocity, smaller, smaller, smaller. They're all myelinated, but the axon diameter is different. Now, if you look at the unmyelinated type, but an extra whammy, they're super small, they have a very slow conduction velocity. Okay, so the take-homes. Myelination, speed it up. Size of the axon, speed it up. Smaller, slow. But you can compensate for that by myelinating it. All right. And if you look at gap junctions, like between two nerves that are actually electrical conducting, these are those little cell, the proteins that can go together and allow electrical synapses. So another way to speed up conduction between two cells is to have electrical synapses. You have very few of these in your body. There's just a few in the part in your brain called the superior olive. But you have other gap junctions in other parts of your body, like the heart we talked about. Smooth muscle has gap junctions, allows electrical events to travel. But other animals will have these fast electrical signals to, like we said, for escape responses. What's really interesting is you can put an electric current in one side and record it in the other side, and you might get an electrical signal to travel faster or give a very big response this way, like you see it's dropped a little bit. And you try it the other way, and you get a different response. It's not the same. They rectify, and people are still trying to understand gap junctions. And it's kind of confusing because how can it travel, how can it allow electricity to travel better one way than the other way, right? That's kind of odd. It's something to do about the protein structure. Also, gap junctions are very susceptible to pH changes. So if the pH drops into your cell, it can alter that property of the gap junction. So that's why acidosis can be bad for your heart too, right? And so this is really quite neat to think about these kind of circuits. And then we get into synaptic transmission. So I think to give a little overview makes it a lot easier, and then we can kind of speed through some of these PowerPoints. I mean, they're just like, put. But they're up there to help you
work through some of those details. But if I actually draw this out, it makes it a lot, I think, more sense, and because step by step, and you can draw at the same rate, basically. So let's look at this at a nerve terminal. Say a motor nerve terminal at your neuromuscular junction, where you want to get that $100, right? So we have a nerve terminal at your neuromuscular junction. Okay, there's your neuromuscular junction. What's inside this nerve terminal? Vesicles, packaged with transmitter, acetylcholine in this case, at your neuromuscular junctions. Okay? Some of these vesicles are right at the membrane. Some of them are a little away from the membrane. Now we have an action potential traveling down this axon. And we recorded that. There it is, traveling down. There's something different about the nerve terminal, though. The nerve terminal has voltage-gated calcium channels. All right. The axon might not have that many. It doesn't need them. Calcium coming in the axon doesn't really do anything for it that much. But at the nerve terminal, there's something unique about the ability of this calcium having a property. What it does, they're voltage-gated, right? So as the action potential comes down here, think about the shape of the action potential, like test questions. And this is why it's important to try to record that nerve terminal, like the $100 bet I'm getting you, to make you think about this. It might be wider. Why would it be wider? Because if we look at the E calcium, remember the Nernst equation, Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz, all that good stuff, is probably around a plus 120. Very low calcium inside the cell and higher calcium outside. Probably like 1 times 10 to the minus 6 calcium inside the nerve terminals of you, and then higher on the outside. So there's a big difference. So the E calcium is very large positive value. So if you have 120 millivolts driving gradient at the nerve terminal, when those voltage-gated calcium channels open, whew, calcium wants to go in, right? It's got 120 millivolt driving gradient. So calcium is going to rush in there, and black magic occurs. No, I'm joking. I want to make sure you're paying attention. Calcium is unique inside of the nerve terminal. If you looked at the proteins here that are on the vesicle, and I'll just redraw this really big for you. The proteins that are on the vesicle and on the presynaptic membrane right here, like that, these proteins interact with each other, okay? So we're at that little spot enlarged over here. Let's just draw another line like this, another protein, okay? This protein has a name called synaptotagmin. They named it really cool names. Another guy got a Nobel Prize for this. Sudhoff, another German. He worked at Dallas, Texas, and then he moved on to another place. I think he's in California now. So he discovered this protein called synaptotagmin. Synapse, tag, you get the idea, synaptotagmin. It has binding domains for calcium. So what's really interesting, when calcium comes in and binds to these binding domains, and think of the vesicle wanting to fuse, but it can't. This protein's inhibiting it. But as soon as calcium binds to it, it changes its conformation. So now, when calcium binds, it changes its conformation, goes out of the way, and it still has this calcium that's bound to it, right? Four binding domains. Moves this out of the way, so the vesicle can now pull into the membrane and release its contents. So the idea is it's removing the brake. It's removing the brake. You're at a stoplight. Your brake pad is synaptotagmin. Calcium comes in. You take your foot off the brake. Where's your car starts to go, right? So think of that as the brake. So this is really neat because he found different isoforms of synaptotagmin from Drosophila to humans, and many of the sequence is the same. So that's pretty cool. So you can make mutations in C. elegans or Drosophila and understand the calcium dynamics that goes on. What's really quite interesting is that there's other proteins that hold this vesicle close to the synapse, right? They're holding these. They're docked. If the vesicle's way up here, that doesn't do any good, right? Because it's not close to the membrane. So there are docking proteins that hold these vesicles close to the membrane. And this is the next theory, the guys that worked out this, Lou Rothman at Sloan Kettering in New York, he worked this out, And these are called the snare hypothesis, because it snared the vesicle. And he identified these different proteins. There are some that are bound to the plasma membrane of the cell, some that are bound to the vesicle, and some that hold these two proteins together. That's pretty cool. Guess what? He got the Nobel Prize too, right? Lou Rothman got the Nobel Prize for this. So you see a couple Nobel Prizes right here, because why? This is so fundamental to every animal that has a nervous system, right? All animals have a nervous system. But guess what? These proteins have a high similarity in something you studied in cell. Yeast. Yeast. What? Yeast. Inside the yeast, when it buds, right, and vesicles fuse to the membrane of the yeast, those vesicles have to fuse to that membrane. And guess what? Those proteins are very similar all the way down to yeast. So when they sequenced the yeast proteins and sequenced the animal proteins, they found out they're similar in structure, but they were given different names because the yeast people described those and the animal people described these. So you see how important this is in understanding yeast research, you know, understands how our system works, right? And these proteins. So they got the Nobel Prize for this, and pretty neat. So it's called the snare-snap hypothesis, and they named these different proteins. And so it's pretty cool. They made mutations in Drosophila, show they don't learn well, all those kind of things. You can imagine in humans, there's some that just don't function well, maybe have a protein problem. Okay, so calcium comes in, binds to the synaptic tagmem and releases the break, allows these vesicles to fuse to the membrane. How much calcium comes in? More vesicles fuse. But remember, the action potential only lasts so long, right? So now, what happens to the calcium inside of here? Is it going to stay around? That's a problem, right? Because vesicle fusion, vesicle fusion, vesicle fusion, right? You want it to be able to receive the next electrical signal and release more transmitter again. So the calcium is pumped out. There's actually a pump. It's called a plasma membrane calcium pump. It uses ATP. Pumps calcium out. It's ATP dependent. There's actually even exchangers. So exchange calcium out for, guess what? Sodium in. Isn't that wild? Sodium in. And it's an exchanger. It's not a pump. So it's called an NCX, sodium-calcium exchanger. There's also binding proteins inside the nerve terminal, many of them. You can go over to the library over here, and there's an old book. It's like 10, 15 years old. And they describe calcium binding proteins in different cells. And there's already like 300 known. It's just crazy, right? But you can imagine calcium binding proteins would bind up the calcium. Also, the mitochondria can take up calcium. That's pretty wild too, right? So the take-home here is what? Calcium comes in quickly, allows vesicles to fuse, but it's not hanging around because it wants to be able to be excited again. So what happens? It gets pumped out, gets exchanged out, binds to these proteins, taken up in the mitochondria, and calcium goes down. That's pretty cool. But then what happens to that calcium that bound to those proteins? It can't just keep binding them. You know, it can't be just keep binding them. So those proteins have a disassociation constant associated with them. I know, chemistry, purged, right? KDs, this disassociation constant. So calcium will bind when it's high, but as the calcium gets pumped out of the cell, what happens to the concentration of free calcium inside the nerve terminal? It's dropping. And now calcium can come off those proteins, come out of the mitochondria, and get pumped out. So you see how it works quickly, and then keep it down, right? So now let's think about something. What if we measured inside of the nerve terminal here, I mean inside the muscle fiber, with an intracellular electrode? Okay, so we have an intracellular electrode, we're at RP. Okay, and now we stimulate this nerve multiple times. What's going to happen down here? Multiple stimulations, right? Multiple action potentials come in. So that means calcium channels open, calcium goes in, some of it gets pumped away, but then all of a sudden another action potential comes in, right? Boom, 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 right? And so what's going to happen to the calcium load inside the nerve terminal? If it keeps coming in kind of quickly and doesn't have time to get down back to rest, more vesicles are going to fuse the next time because it's building on the residual calcium. So if we record it in here, we might get something the first time. This is all sub-threshold, okay? It's not making an action potential yet. And then we might get another one, and another one. So you get the idea? This is what happens at the crayfish neuromuscular junction. Those muscles that you looked at, they do not make action potentials. Those are graded responses. They act like the dendrites in your brain. And so we actually see that the amplitude if you measure the amplitude here, this amplitude of B is bigger than A. So B is bigger than A. So the synaptic response is actually bigger with the repetitive stimulations. It's not from the baseline. We're measuring it from the trough to the peak, from this one to the peak. It's actually bigger. And the idea is this is due to residual calcium in the nerve terminal. The gods in the field, Bernard Katz, he described this in the 1950s. And he did this in the crayfish neuromuscular junction, and he did this in the frog neuromuscular junction. And he could do this really kind of neat experiments. Repetitive stimulation, calcium comes in, goes down, but you stimulate it again, more calcium comes in, builds up, and so the vesicles that fuse, we have more that are primed, ready to go, boom, boom, boom. The second time, boom, and the third time, you know, bang, right? A lot of them would fuse together. And how does this all fit with Sudhoff that did the calcium binding with synaptotagmin? Full circle now. I know this is a lot to take in. There's four binding domains in synaptotagmin. But it takes all four for the vesicle to fuse. But what if we had one or two still bound there? Or three, and we only needed the fourth one with that extra stimulation. Synaptotagmin shows cooperativity. The more the calcium bound to it, the higher the probability of vesicle fusion. So it's like what we're going to talk about with hemoglobin and oxygen disassociation and oxygen binding. So it's really cool. You go back to the 50s and you go back to the recent years, pull these two ideas together with the binding domains of synaptotagmin and residual calcium, and this is called synaptic facilitation. Test question. Facilitation. So this is facilitation. This is called short-term facilitation. STF. Short-term facilitation. The mechanism behind this, by Bernard Katz in the 1950s, is due to residual calcium. You can still do these experiments today and reproduce those experiments from the 1950s. Better equipment, but you get the same results. So it's pretty cool. What's really neat while I'm on this tangent for the last minute is now let's wait a couple minutes. We'll wait a couple minutes, okay? And then we'll give a single stimulus again. And now we're going to record in that nerve terminal, and we get the same kind of shape action potential in the nerve terminal, okay? We're waiting a couple minutes. Stay with me for this little bit. But now we record in the muscle fiber or a postsynaptic neuron in your brain, for example. And we waited a few minutes. But we got a bigger response. This one was, say, C. This C response is bigger than that A response. What on earth is going on? The calcium has already gone back to the resting level. It's not due to residual calcium anymore. What is it due to? What do you think it could be due to?
Dissociation.
The dissociation maybe of that calcium could be. That's a good idea. Something. Some other things that we talked about. Why did Paul Greengard get the Nobel Prize? Vesicles get the proteins, get phosphorylated. They come off, right? Phosphorylation-dependent steps. So they know that now, if we block phosphorylation-dependent steps like protein kinase A, what do kinases do? Kinases phosphorylate. So if they block protein kinase A, they didn't see this enhanced response. And this was shown in 1971 science publication by a new graduate student that went to this guy's lab in Canada. So he's a new graduate student, went to this lab, and this guy said, I have some interesting data. If you do this in the crayfish axon, and you stimulate, and you record in the muscle fiber, and I wait a minute or 2 minutes, and I stimulate again, I get a bigger response than I did the first time. This is really odd. It can't be due to the residual calcium. Oh my God, the darn cats is wrong. Something's crazy, right? So they started to work this out, and they found out that if they block the phosphorylation-dependent steps inside the axon, which you can do in crayfish axons because you can inject substances in the axon, they block the response. This was Sherman. He's a new graduate student, his first year in lab, and he got a science paper out of it, 1971. It's like the premier journal, Science, 1971. Wow, he got his dissertation, walk out the door. He went to Miami, Oxford, Ohio, Miami University. He worked there for a number of years. He was a pre-med advisor. He retired from there. When I came here, I found out he was there. I went to meet him at a seminar. It was great. And, you know, he stopped research a long time ago, went into administration. But still, his theories and his findings in 1971 was called LTA, long-term adaptation. Okay, he named that in
okay. I found this on the web from what's called
okay.
I wonder if it's trying to find Sherman and Abbott in 1971 science paper. That same year, later in the year, so this is published in Science, just to get you thinking about the nature of science. Some Swedes published a paper, Bliss and Lomo, using the hippocampus and the rat. Repetitively stimulated, showed short-term facilitation, but then when they stopped and they stimulated again, they got a bigger response. Guess what? Hey, LTP, long-term potentiation described in a Nature paper. Same year, months later, never cited the Science paper that actually showed it first in the Crater's neuromuscular junction. Same mechanism. Long-term potentiation we'll talk about later, but you get the idea, right? In the nature of science, publishing things are important because then you can document that you were the one that described them. Good.